Welcome to the Agile Book Club. Here are your hosts, Justina and Paul.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Agile Book Club podcast. This is your host, Paul Klipp. And why am I alone? I wasn't alone when I originally recorded the introduction for this episode, but we were using a voiceover IP service and it choked. And so while the interview that is to come was absolutely fabulous because we used a different service, we have lost the audio from the original intro that Justina and I recorded. So you've got me, just me, only me. And what that means is we're going to be getting right into the interview straight away, toot sweet. So if you enjoy the banter between me and Justina, and by that I mean, I guess, mostly Justina, because I'm sure my rants aren't all that entertaining, then you can go back to the last episode because we published 46 minutes of just Justina and I talking about nothing from our last after show, which was shared with the entire listening public. So you can go back and listen to that if you just want to hear more of Justina and I bantering. But otherwise, if you want to just get straight to the meat of things, let's get right to it with the interview that is the reason for making this episode in the first place, and I think you're going to love it. So join us now for a conversation with two of the three authors of the Zombie Scrum Survival Guide, Christine Verwes and Johannes Schwartau. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's so nice that you invited us to talk about the book, but also to talk with you, because I listened to your podcast yesterday. It was a pleasure. You have a really wonderful podcast. I haven't heard it before, but you really took an effort to explain what the book is about. It's wonderful.
Yeah, not only that, but it also meant a lot to us. I'm just speaking on behalf of Christian and Barry, that we spend a lot of time writing these things and then someone actually understands them. That's kind of magical and also highly appreciated.
Well, it was delightful. And like I said, one of the things that I really enjoy about it is I get so tired of reading books, another Me Too book about how to do something that everybody has supposedly known how to do for 20 years. And so it's really nice that the Scrum community has gotten to the point at which it's observing the same patterns of pathology. And those can be categorized and responded to appropriately. And so it's really nice to read a Scrum book that doesn't try to teach me Scrum again.
To be honest, we had a small section in there in which we explained Scrum again, but in a different way. Because we feel like, so the people we meet, first of all, often they haven't actually read the Scrum Guide, which is kind of the first thing you should probably do. But then the Scrum Guide, I think it's a great little thing that explains it, but also leaves out a lot. And so we had this section that explained everything around it and kind of the purpose, or got more into the purpose of it. And then we decided to take it out and it was published as a white paper.
Ah, okay. I can certainly see why. I see the same thing with the Scrum Guide and with the Kanban Guide that's out now, and with the Kanban for Scrum Team Guide, is that it's really difficult to talk about the why, because it's so easy to get caught up in the what.
Exactly, yeah. And we're very happy that the reviewers were so strict, and that the recommendation was just don't describe the Scrum framework. Let the Scrum Guide's already there, and we're very happy now that the Scrum Guide has changed. It means that we don't have to rewrite our book. That's also nice, because the message is the same still.
So I've got this trick that I like to use when talking about Kanban, because people ask me about Kanban a lot, and I have my way of introducing Kanban that makes people who think they know what Kanban is raise their eyebrow. You know, that explanation that is true, and yet it opens up possibilities for reframing Kanban. I suspect you have something similar for Scrum. How do you describe Scrum to somebody when you want to surprise them?
Well, to be honest, we usually start, Barry, I teach a lot of professional Scrum Master 1 and 2 classes with Barry, and we always start by saying that we don't care about Scrum. I think I don't think we mention that in the book, but we do mention that in the white paper where we re-explain Scrum, but that's usually what we start with. And then people are like, what? Why are you teaching a Scrum class and you don't care about Scrum? And then we explain, no, it's not about Scrum. It's about what it makes possible for your team, for your organization, for your stakeholders. And that definitely raises some eyebrows, and I think it's a good way to start. But I'm curious, Johannes, what do you do?
I talk about Toast.
Oh,
so tell me more. I have these exercises that I do for different problem domains, and we don't talk about Scrum at all in the beginning, and it's mostly about understanding complexity and different approaches to different types of problems, and then that leads into why Scrum might be a good tool for a certain set of problems.
That's a great way to explain it. Actually, it reminds me that a while ago, I used to start all my workshops and trainings about Scrum by a story. It's unfortunate that the documentary is only available in Dutch, but it's about the renovation of the Central Museum in Amsterdam. And it's just hilarious what happened there, because at one point they painted the whole museum in one color, and then the director walks in and he's like, "No, I wanted a different color." And for me, that's one of those examples that explains why you'd want to do things incrementally. Why didn't they just paint one room in a new color, check if that was okay, and then paint the rest? But no, they painted the whole thing. And the documentary has many similar examples of all these typical waterfall issues that you see. So that's usually how I explained it up to a few years ago, actually.
And that's an explanation that really resonates, because especially when you're in a large corporation and when you're talking to teams, so often they have a backlog and they don't know where it came from, but they trust that whoever put that stuff there must know what they're doing because they're being paid more than they are.
Exactly, yeah.
So if you don't question whether you're doing the right thing or not, you won't get an answer to that question until it's way too late.
And actually, speaking about backlogging, one of the experiments that you suggested in the book was to limit the backlog, to don't make it like the endless wish list. How did it happen in the real life? If you maybe have an example, as a story, mm-hmm. a conversation with the product owner, and you tell them, like, you know, backlog also has to have a limit.
I have a friend, and he has this technique where he prints out all the Jira tickets in the backlog, and people think he's insane because then he covers the whole floor and you can just see physically how much accumulates into a backlog that is often virtual. And I've worked with a lot of Scrum teams, and I don't know how it really got started, but it's just that there's so much in there often that it's not really needed, and then you really lose the focus, and all the things that are needed and are really important, they don't take the place in people's mind that they deserve. And that's something we discussed while we wrote the book, that we like to do this and kind of, you know, just to give people a focus and kind of make them think about the question, what really needs to be in there and in what kind of detail, so that it actually becomes manageable. Because if you have 1,000 things in your backlog, that's not something that you can hold in your mind at all. So, yeah, that's why we propose limiting the backlog, so that you really put the things in that matter the most and that people can still process cognitively.
You go a step further, in fact. Because I've heard about the secret backlog. A lot of people have the secret backlog because it's reasonable. It's reasonable for someone to say that even if we're not going to get around to some of these ideas for months or years, the ideas themselves have value. But you propose that it's not enough just to take them off of the backlog and put them into some secret list someplace. You should absolutely, totally destroy those backlog items. Why is that? They have value, but what danger do they pose?
Well, I think one of the problems with really long product backlogs is that you feel this responsibility that you still have to remember what all these things mean. So when you go over it again, I've been part of so many conversations within Scrum teams where we were looking at item number 305 on the product backlog, and there was this talk about what did we intend with this again? What was it about again? For me, that's wasteful. It's just time you could have spent elsewhere. And I fully believe that if there's a good idea on your product backlog that you have to let go of because it's already too long and it's not at the top, it'll come back, because good ideas have this habit of returning because they're good ideas. And if they don't, well, that's a sign too. And that's what I like about making it explicit by throwing away the items that you're not actually going to keep on your product backlog. Sometimes we actually take a trash can, we put it next to, we usually do it with magic estimation where people put all the items on the floor, a bit like what Johannes explained. And then we pull in a trash can and we say, okay, let's physically remove all the items that are not going to happen. And sometimes that's a very hard conversation because there's sometimes a stakeholder in the room who's like, whoa, but that was my key feature. But it's also a way to create transparency around what you are going to do and what you're not going to do, because apparently that was not important enough.
You know, that reminds me of something that Marie Kondo said about cleaning out your library. You know, getting rid of books is a really painful thing to do. And all of us who are involved in knowledge pursuits tend to accumulate books. And one of the things she said is that the right time to read a book is when you acquire it. And if you've missed that opportunity, then maybe you should let somebody else have it.
I'm looking at my books now and thinking, oh, that's actually quite a lot that I haven't read. So
I have a lot of respect for Marie Kondo, but I strongly disagree. No, but so books, I think they also serve a different purpose. They're also a conversation piece and decorative item and things like that. But circling back to product backlog, I mean, the other question is, what type of product backlog items do you have in your backlog, right? So it doesn't have to be fully formed user stories or things like that. It could also just be, these are the problems that we need to tackle soon, or these are the conversations that we need to have. And probably you don't have to tackle all the problems at once, so you don't have to have all the conversations at the same time. And that also helps you just kind of keep it lean. But I feel like when we write down everything we need to do and get into this mode of specifying features and specifying tasks, then that is already kind of the first step towards trying to cram everything in there that you can.
It's interesting, actually, that at the moment, Barry, Johannes, and I are working on a couple of, for example, the Zombie Scrum survey that you also noticed in some of the questions that you already prepared. This is a product that we're working on, and we have a product backlog for it. But sometimes there's this idea that comes up while I'm working on something, and I'm like, I have to put that on the product backlog because we have to talk about that. And then I think, no, I'm not going to put it on. If it's a good idea, it'll emerge again later, because otherwise we're going to end up with 100 things on the product backlog, and it doesn't make sense. So, and that's very hard. It's very difficult not to put something on there, or to just remove something that's been on there for a long time, but you keep pushing it down. But it's super important.
Can we take this back to a higher level, just for the benefit of our listeners? We've got to keep in mind that a lot of people dip into this podcast from time to time. We've got our loyal listeners who listen to every single episode. But for a fair number of people, that this is going to be the first one that they listen to. And we haven't really addressed the question of what we're talking about, which is this phenomenon that you call Zombie Scrum. Could you introduce our listeners to what Zombie Scrum is and how it varies from healthy Scrum or from other Scrum anti-patterns?
For me, it are Scrum teams that are not delivering tangible, useful outcomes on a sprint basis to their stakeholders. Stakeholders are not ever present during sprint reviews, or very rarely so. And by stakeholders in this case, we're really talking about users and customers, people that actually have a stake in the product. Developers don't talk to them, and the product owner probably does either. Teams don't have autonomy to make decisions, and nobody's trying to improve anything. So it's really like you have Zombie Scrum when the people in your Scrum team are walking to another pointless Scrum meeting with those blank eyes, because nothing useful is going to happen there at all. There's just no beating heart. And for us, that's what Zombie Scrum is all about.
Right. And I mean, if you look at Scrum, it's this essentially the heartbeat of the sprint rhythm and delivering increments, right? So what that does is it helps you learn and solve a problem. But if the people involved don't know what that problem is or what there's to learn, because that loop is broken, or that learning simply doesn't happen because there's such a big distance to the area in which the problem occurs, then that's when you get zombie scrum. So when that's when people, that's how we came up with the metaphor. Essentially, it's, you know, people are walking around, but they don't have that beating heart. And the thing that makes Scrum so useful, you know, solving complex problems, it's not being used for what it was designed for. And yeah, that's what we call zombie Scrum.
And the irony is that it actually looks like Scrum from a distance. So you have the roles, you have a Scrum Master, you have a product owner, you have developers, you have the artifacts, you have the Scrum events, but there's no soul. And that's the irony of it. It looks like Scrum, but it's not.
So it's not like Scrum, but in this case, you're doing everything right. You're just doing it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to describe it. Yeah, you don't understand what it's for. So you're using a tool without knowing what you need to use it for, what problem it's trying to solve.
And do you think that is it possible for a zombie Scrum team, you know, to recover from that state if they operate in such a zombie organization, you know?
It's definitely possible. So the book that we wrote is kind of a tool for people who find themselves in these kind of organizations or systems, and they don't have the power to change that immediately. I mean, it's definitely possible that some kind of CEO, for example, picks up the book and then has an epiphany and starts changing structures and everything. But that's not what we see most of the time. So the people that we talk to are mostly Scrum Masters, product owners, developers, or just people in organizations that use Agile, and they're kind of frustrated, but they don't have the power to change the whole structure. And that's, you know, we wrote this book for these people. And that's why the focus in the book is on these small experiments that you can do to make some kind of progress. And that's something that we believe is really important, that if you don't have the power to change the whole system overnight, or, I mean, in the foreseeable future, then you need to do something to still make progress and kind of chip away at that state and improve in small increments. And we definitely believe that's possible, and we've seen it work. It's, you know, it doesn't always get to that perfect state of, you know, the things that people at conferences talk about and that idealized version of Scrum that people seem to chase all the time. But what we definitely have seen is a reduction in suffering. I mean, the people in those systems, they're usually not that happy, or they kind of get dragged along. And it's not that they're actively shaping the environment. And that's something that is often very frustrating. If you can see some kind of progress and some kind of improvement, then that often leads to the next step and other people kind of wanting to help, or, you know, seeing the improvement and kind of getting a bit more enthusiasm and a bit more energy to go on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to add to that is, one of the, I think that Barry, Johannes, and I are all fortunate to have come from a background where we've seen Scrum work really well with the teams that we worked with, that we were Scrum Masters for. But the hard part for me was that when I started in this work, I was fully convinced of what Scrum would make possible for organizations and for people individually too. And I saw that happening in the teams that I was working with or that I was a part of. But then I went to conferences and we started doing workshops and training, and people would often come to me and ask, so have you ever seen this work for real? I mean, have you ever seen successful Scrum? I know what it could be like, but have you ever seen it? I've never seen it. And that happens quite often, to be honest. And it always surprises me that, and I understand why, because it's really hard to do some of those things. At the same time, it isn't. And I think that that's one of the reasons we wanted to write this book, was to share some of the things that worked for us. I'm not sure if they're going to work for all the readers, but at least to give a sense of hope. Like, this is something you can change and you can do. And it may be very difficult in some organizations, but maybe it isn't all that difficult. You just need to start, well, pushing the right buttons.
Well, this is something that I wanted to address, because you see it so often in organizations where every single team has a Scrum Master. There's a reasonably sized team of 6 to 8 people, and there's one Scrum Master, and that's the Scrum Master for that team. They're responsible for helping that team in their Scrum journey. How does, because what you're talking about is also taking responsibility for systemic improvement outside of the team, which I think is absolutely crucial, because obviously most of the constraints that are placed on a team are not internal to the team, but external to the team. How does a Scrum Master balance their responsibility to the team with the need to engage with a larger organization?
Well, to me, that's one and the same. And I usually see the team as kind of the sensor of what's going on in the larger organization. And when I train Scrum Masters, for example, and work with people inside the Scrum team, what I tell them is that I kind of expect a Scrum Master to be very active within the team in the very beginning. So when you start setting up a team and kind of make sure that people get what Scrum is, and you know, you'll be more, your responsibility will be on making sure that the events actually take place and the people know the purpose of all the events and the roles and everything, but always with the aim of having people or guiding people into their independence and you know, fostering that ability to do these things on their own. And then if you've done that and the team is kind of stable enough, then usually that's when all these problems are starting to pop up. And I think that's the time when you need to work in the larger organization and work together with other Scrum Masters and kind of see what is happening in other teams as well. So if you have an issue within your team or something that your team, an impediment that is getting raised in a retrospective or something like that, then I would always talk to other Scrum Masters and see, is this something that is happening in the large organization, or is that just us? And the good news is, if it's just us, then maybe it's easier to solve. But usually you run into issues that have deep systemic causes, and that's not something that you can usually solve by yourself. But those are the issues, if you get them solved together with other people, they really make a difference. So you can kind of use your team as the place where you see all these issues pop up, and where you can, you know, just feel into what is happening in the rest of the organization. But then usually you have to look outside of your team to find a solution for that.
Yeah, you're touching a really important point there. Yeah. That the Scrum teams are excellent sensors to see what's going on in the rest of the organization. And we described this also in the book, in the fifth part about self-organization, that if you focus on making sure that those individual Scrum teams are able to deliver working software every sprint and they can collaborate with stakeholders, then a lot of those other problems will become visible and you can start solving them. You can do it on your own because you'll need to work with other Scrum Masters and product owners, management, stakeholders, members of the Scrum teams. But at least then you have something to work with. And that's what I like so much about this metaphor of the Scrum team as a sensor.
I don't recall that in the book. Did I miss that?
I don't know if we actually call it sensor. I think that Johannes, did we do that? I don't think we mentioned that, but we do talk about how the Scrum teams are the units that help you see what's going on and that they are sort of the drivers of self-organization throughout the organization.
Yeah, I don't think that phrase is in the book particularly, but I mean, there's always a balance, because also at the same time, what happens is that you want Scrum teams to have more autonomy, right? And so trying to get more autonomy for the teams is going to cause some kind of issue within the organization. But that's kind of the purpose of Scrum, right? And so my friend Michael Hammond, he was one of the first Scrum trainers and studied with Ken Schwaber. He told me that in the beginning, Ken Schwaber always said that Scrum was designed to cause organizational breakdowns. And I think that's I don't think that's something that you can tell people when you try to sell Scrum, or it sounds pretty uncomfortable. I think that's exactly what it is. People should be aware of the fact that if you use Scrum, then something is definitely going to break. And that's the purpose of it. It's not like we are running into issues, oh, this shouldn't happen, but no, this is exactly what is supposed to happen. And if you use Scrum, it's not this nice little thing that you put into your teams and they do something different and then you get some more output. That's not what's going to happen. Never. But if you take care of those issues, it's going to be really awesome.
Yes, indeed. If I could come back just for a second to something that you mentioned at the beginning of the interview. You said about your online zombie scrum survey. When I was reading the book and then I did survey by myself as well, I was just curious, what was the most surprising outcome for you, Johannes, for example?
You mean from the data?
Yes, from the data. Something that, you know, just kept your eyes wide open and like, oh my God.
Well, so the thing is that the survey was one of the first things we actually did, and it shaped the book itself, because when we talked about zombie scrum, we also had to talk about healthy scrum. And then we started thinking about, you know, how would you ask questions to find out that people might be infected, right? And so that essentially we came up with all these questions we could think of, and then we tried to categorize them and kind of realized, okay, we probably have four categories here that kind of define healthy scrum in a way. And I just have to say that Christian did an incredible job, because he's the genius behind the survey, and he's able to answer a lot more questions about it. But he's got all these metrics that he's finding in there, and he's pulling so much data out of it. And like, sometimes he sends an update, and he, how many questions did you take out again between version one and two?
We started with 130, and I think I removed 50 or something.
Right. And that's because, you know, he was able to say, this question doesn't really answer anything, or these questions do kind of the same. And so I just want to point out that it's not just like a casual survey, but it's actually, there's a lot of science behind it that I don't understand, but Christian does.
And
so, so I would be great if you could just, so some of the key takeaways for me, for example, was that there are two indicators that kind of tell you all you need to know. So for example, cross-functionality. If a team scores high in cross-functionality, then most of the other things fall into place. And so if you start anywhere, that is probably one of the first areas that you want to focus on to see if all the skills that are needed to release product increments in one team are actually present, right? And they correlate with support from management, and I think also the ability to release fast and stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, Christian, I don't know if you want to take over, but I thought that was really interesting that you can kind of trace it down to maybe two key points. And if you focus on those, then yeah, you almost got it.
Hmm. Yeah, well, it's already a really good explanation of what we have, I think. And it's also a bit of, I have a background in organizational psychology. So as a science, I have a background in science, but I have no way to do it because my work is in a different area. But this is a good opportunity to still practice those skills and to collect data that may also be very valuable, not just to us and the work that we're doing and to the scrum teams out there, but also for scientists. So we're actually working right now with people to analyze this and maybe publish this in peer-reviewed journals, so we can actually build on our understanding of what creates successful scrum teams and what causes zombie scrum. So one of the things that we found, for example, that surprised me is that we, in the initial version, we measured psychological safety and we measured cross-functionality as two different things, but we were unable to distinguish between those two things. So apparently they are so connected that they're technically the same thing. And I think that that's important because a lot of people think about cross-functionality only from a task-oriented perspective, where it's all about people doing the same tasks or helping each other with tasks. But in order to do that, psychological safety is super important. Without psychological safety, none of that will happen because people won't offer help and they won't ask for help. And that's something that we found with the earlier analysis that we've done. And what was also surprising to me was that we were able to see that there are effective Scrum teams in all kinds of organizations, no matter how large they are, if they're in the banking sector, insurance sector, wherever they are, there are successful Scrum teams. And in fact, the size of the organization, the age of the organization, the amount of experience with Scrum, it doesn't seem to have a lot of influence on how successful you can be with Scrum. And I think that's very hopeful because I meet a lot of people who tell me in person, you know, I can see Scrum working for a small company like a startup, but not for a bank. Well, we know it works for banks because we can tell from the data.
Could we go back to what you were talking about, cross-functional teams? Because I want to make a distinction clear for our listeners, which I think is really important. And that is that, you know, when you're in an organization where it's very difficult to drive change outside of the team, one of the pieces of low-hanging fruit is improving the staff liquidity within the team. And there's definitely a distinction between a team that has all of the functional components, say a team that's been put together by management based on their CVs or their resumes to have the right skills, and a team of people who actually collaborate together and take joint responsibility for keeping work going rather than just focusing on their own very narrow specializations. So could you define a healthy kind of cross-functionalism as opposed to manufactured cross-functionalism?
And how would you describe manufactured cross-functionalism in that case? What does that look like?
Well, I'm describing a scenario in which, for example, I was in an organization once that was trying to put together 13 teams simultaneously, and it was all being done by HR. So 13 teams were manufactured to make sure that they each had one senior back-end programmer, two front-end programmers, two testers, one of whom was an automation tester, the other of whom was a manual tester. And there was no expectation of collaboration or overlap between these roles. And so what tended to happen in the early days, at least, is that with each person recognizing their responsibility as being a very, very narrow functional responsibility, necessarily the first bottlenecks that the team ran into were internal.
Mm-hmm.
The testers too busy, so everything's stopping in front of testing, for example.
And there was probably a very nice Excel sheet that HR created where they tried to plot all the people across the teams. I've seen that happen a couple of times.
Yeah,
something like that. Well, one example of this, the opposite of this essentially, is I worked for a client once, and the management there was adamant that they wanted to decide who should be in which team. And eventually we settled on a solution where instead of forming the teams, management made a proposal. So they sort of suggested, like, this is something that we could see working. But then we left it to the people themselves to decide how to change the composition of the teams based on the purpose of the teams. So each of the Scrum teams was going to be responsible for one product or a category of related products. And there was also a requirement that at least there should be someone who was capable. It should be possible for the team to do design work, to do test work, to document things, to talk to stakeholders. So these skills should be part of those teams, but it was up to the people to decide how to actually distribute themselves across the teams to make that happen. And it wasn't perfect. There were still issues that we ran into, but one of the great things about this was that over the weeks that followed, the composition actually continued to change because people were discovering that it was better for developer X to be in that team and developer Y to be in that team. And I think that's a good example of healthy cross-functionality, because this is also empirical work. You're figuring out along the way, what is the best composition of our team? What people do we need? What skills do we need? So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that would be how I would see it.
Well, you addressed it very nicely in the book when you were talking about, I don't know if you actually use the expression developing T-shaped employees, which is, I'm not very thrilled with that expression either. It sounds too mechanistic. But the idea that the team has a shared responsibility for making sure that it is smoothly and consistently delivering value. And that means the whole team being concerned about the flow of work in the system, not the flow of work through their particular domain. So if, for example, the tester is having issues and she's got work piling up in front of her. That's the team's responsibility to find a solution. And that might involve doing more testing up front. It might involve doing more automated testing. It might involve changing the way in which they work with the tester. But that's the team's responsibility, not the tester's responsibility to solve.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the other thing is, of course, sometimes you kind of realize that you might need someone from outside the team on your team permanently. And one of the experiments that we mentioned in the book, is when a team uses permission tokens. So anytime you are dependent on someone else outside of your team and need to ask for permission or need someone else to do something, then you put a token into a jar. And then at the end, you look at the end of the sprint, you kind of look at the jar and kind of see, you know, this many times we had to ask for this and that many times for that. And I mean, sometimes the solution is if you kind of find out that you always need to ask the same person for something that the team needs, then maybe that person needs to be on the team, right? So because they're involved in creating that increment directly. And so why are they outside of the team? I mean, it's not, you know, I mean, organizational boundaries might play into that, but generally that's a question that you should definitely ask. And that way often teams kind of evolve and maybe someone else comes into the team that hadn't been there before.
You were describing in the book one of the reasons why zombie scrum tends to evolve, tends to emerge, and that is this tendency of organizations going through an agile transformation to look at the current people that they have and try to match them up to new roles. So, for example, it seems natural that everyone who is a project manager should now be a scrum master, and it seems natural that people who are analysts should now be product owners. What would you say to people in this sort of a position, people who are just told that yesterday you were a project manager, tomorrow you'll be a scrum master, yesterday you were an analyst, tomorrow you're going to be a product owner, to prepare them for the significant difference in the responsibility of the new role?
My first response to that would be that might not be possible within a day, but to find other people in the community. There we have a wonderful worldwide community of Scrum practitioners. Find a product owner that can help you get into the role, like not a coach, but a product owner who's doing that work on a day-to-day basis. If you're going to be Scrum Master and you have a background as a project manager, find a Scrum Master who's been doing it for a long time and is a good example of how you can fulfill the role. I think that peer support is one of the best things you can find. If you don't have that, obviously you can read a book or read blog posts, but I really believe in the power of community and how they can help you understand what the role is about, because that takes time, especially if you come from a role that's very different. Like a project manager has a very different perspective on how to reduce risks than a product owner. So having someone who has a lot of experience in that role is going to be very useful.
I wonder if that's not even... Let me try to phrase this correctly. This is one of the things I love about podcasting. I can make mistakes and edit it. I can stop and think if I need to stop and think, and then I just edit out the silence. But it sounds so natural when I say it that it's almost unquestioned that the most likely candidate for a Scrum Master would be a current project manager, and the most likely candidate for a product owner would be an analyst. But given the drastically different nature of those roles, is it possible that the apparent synergies are actually damaging, and that perhaps doing away with that assumption altogether might be healthier?
Yes.
Well, I would say yes to that, but I'll give you honest the first arguments for why. But, yeah.
Well, I mean, one of the big distinctions we often make is between complicated and complex problems, right? And there's an argument to be made that project managers are often very good at managing complicated problems, while Scrum is a tool for managing complex problems, right? And I mean, that's a bit black and white, but generally, that's maybe a distinction we can make. And I often see that people who've done or who are kind of entrenched in that kind of thinking tend to slip back into it and try to bring that thinking into that new form of working together, right? And so that can definitely make it more difficult for these people to understand that it is completely different. It's not just a different name for the same thing, but it's not just a completely different way of doing things, but actually a different way of thinking about things, right? And so, I mean, that's why when I talk to people about Agile and give about Scrum, and you know, we do introductions and talk about their role and everything, then I really make sure that they have some kind of experience and know that this is something different. It's not the same thing. It's a fundamentally different approach. And then, I mean, if people understand that, then sometimes they can grasp, you know, in what direction it goes and if that's something they want to do. But I've also seen that other people kind of have that understanding, or that kind of understanding comes more naturally to them, and maybe then they're more suited to that role. But of course, from a traditional perspective, like you said, like human resources department or something, that's difficult, and you really have to talk to people, and you can't just look at items on a spreadsheet. But you have to, you have to get into people's minds and talk to them about it and kind of explain what Scrum really is.
Well, I wanted to add that maybe that is also one of the problems that you have when you talk about roles in general. Like a project manager is a role, but there are project managers that are that completely understand that you need to work empirically and that you cannot plan ahead very far into the future because it's complex work. And you have project managers who plan everything for a year ahead. So I think it's hard to say that you cannot be a good Scrum Master if you're a project manager. But that's one of the things, that the issues that I personally have with using roles. It's more about your accountabilities, your responsibilities. I like the change that they made in a new Scrum guide that emphasizes that more strongly. But that's just a thought that came up while I was listening to Johannes.
Well, clearly it's going to be a mistake to apply generalizations on the ground. The individual people you're talking about matter. But to the extent the generalizations are useful, when I was listening to Johannes describe this transition, the differences between the nature of the way in which a project manager thinks about their job and the way in which a Scrum Master thinks about solving problems, it seems like a healthier generalization might be to look first to your designers when you're going through an Agile transformation. People who are used to complex problems that they have to coordinate with real users in order to solve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Yeah,
and they would naturally assume that they're going to be doing something very different. If you have to overcome an assumption that this job is going to be kind of similar to my previous job, then you've got a bigger hurdle to get over than somebody who is definitely facing a new experience.
Yeah, but the same goes, I think, for developers. And I don't mean developer in the sense of someone who's sitting behind a computer writing code the whole day. For me, a developer is also someone who talks to users and who cares about how the users feel about the product. So a developer can also be a really good product owner. Not every developer, but there are definitely developers out there who can do that. And the same goes for being Scrum Master. I think developers would make excellent Scrum Masters for the same reasons as you described, Paul. So yeah, absolutely.
So something that's been troubling me, and it's troubled me for a long time, it's one of the reasons why I don't do much training anymore as well, is the question of, given the way that you've described Zombie Scrum as a group of people who are going through all of the motions and yet not feeling that beating heartbeat, not doing it for the right reasons, is it possible that there is a problem with the way in which we have created an industry that unintentionally communicates the idea that in order to transition from not being a member of a Scrum team to becoming a member of a Scrum team requires a two-day training? Are we creating Scrum teams because of the way we teach Scrum? I mean, creating zombie Scrum teams because of the way we teach Scrum.
So you're asking a professional Scrum trainer for Scrum.org and a trainer for Scrum Alliance. So what do you think about training? Well, the honest answer is yes. I think that the way training is done can easily contribute to Zombie Scrum. And I know we have a lot of discussions about this within Scrum.org community too. And for example, this is one of the reasons why the Professional Scrum Master 2 class that we created there is entirely focused on the purpose and the principles of Scrum and not on the mechanics, because the mechanics, you can read those in a book, the artifacts, the roles, the other things, but understanding why you're doing this and how all those elements of the Scrum framework make that possible and how to deal with all those really tough situations that you're going to find yourself in, that's, I think, something that training should be focused on. Not entirely, but it should be a lot more important. And I think one of the reasons why you see a lot of Zombie Scrum is because there are, unfortunately, a lot of trainings, 2 day, 1 day, even a week long, that focus entirely on the mechanics and nothing else. And that doesn't help.
It sounds like perhaps now, I haven't taken either of these courses because I'm old enough to have all my Scrum training from the Scrum Alliance. But
you're fortunate.
Back when these didn't exist. But based on what you've just described, it sounds like it might be valuable to invert those two, to make sure that people have a solid foundation in the principles before you tell them how to do the work.
I've been wondering about that, and I really like the idea. One question that always pops up next for me is when I reflect on my own learning journey into Scrum, and I'm curious about what your experience is as the others, is that for me, when I started with Scrum, I needed to know what to do. So when I read the Scrum guide and it told me, okay, we need to have these three roles, these events, these artifacts, this is apparently how we should do it. My understanding of the purpose and the principles sort of grew as I started applying that in practice. So I don't know if I would have been helped with a start by focusing entirely on the purpose and the principles, and then much later talk more about the mechanics. I don't know if that would have worked for me, but it's an experiment. I think it would be good to try.
I you know, to be honest, listening and reflecting back on the last few minutes of this conversation, especially considering the sensitive topics involved and the fact that you are both professional Scrum trainers, I think I will probably edit that portion out of this podcast. I don't want this podcast to be a place where we criticize any community and the way in which they earn their living. So pretend that didn't happen.
but for me, I'm not sure, Johannes, about you, but I don't have an issue with this. I think that this is a discussion that we're having in the trainer community too. So,
well, I'm not an official trainer for the Scrum Alliance anyway. So, but I don't know. I think as a community, we should be able to talk about this.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was too offensive. So there are different ways of doing these trainings. And I think it's even important that we call it out when people just focus on the mechanics. And also, some Scrum trainers have been training for years, but don't actually have any experience, or they don't have a lot of experience, or they don't continuously coach teams. And that was one of the reasons why, I was at a point where I asked myself whether I wanted to become a CST. I actually did some code trainings and everything. But I thought it was so tempting to just stand there and tell a compelling story. And then it all makes sense within the training, but then people go out and they have an experience. It was really, like, for me, it was really important to make sure that I still do this with people on the ground and I have that experience. And if I do trainings, then, I mean, I do trainings for people inside of companies, for example. And then what I really try to emphasize is this is going to be difficult. And I structure my trainings in a specific way so that they actually understand the principles first. But exactly as Christian said, for me, that understanding also grew through the practice. And I went through the 2 day training and then kind of tried to apply all that knowledge and then failed and then learned from it. but maybe. Yeah, what I'm thinking is maybe there's a quicker way to that to that knowledge. And I mean, you don't have to do all the mistakes again, right? And it could help for people to know some of the principles, because I personally believe if you know the principles, then you can kind of explain a lot for yourself, or a lot of things in the Scrum Guide, for example, read very differently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Indeed. So I don't know how far to get into this, but I do have an observation, and that is that I remember in the early days, in the burst of growth in the Scrum Alliance, and here I guess I'm thinking back to like 2006 or 7 for the next 4 or 5 years, when being a Scrum trainer was often equated with a license to print money, because there weren't a lot of them, and even though there certainly weren't enough to serve the demand, and the money was so easy because you could just get 30 people into a training class every weekend if you wanted to, that it really discouraged moving back and forth between training and practicing. Now I wonder if it's more healthy, because with the two different Scrum training organizations and with the huge number of trainers that are out there right now, I think trainers probably have more flexibility to train, consult, get different experiences.
Yeah, I think so. To keep learning about what they teach, right? To keep having new stories, fresh stories about how they work with Scrum teams. Yeah, I think that's a really positive change.
Okay, so I'm going to have an interesting time editing that. I'm not going to promise I'm going to keep it in or not.
Well, you can keep it for after show. After show is
well,
for the
if I put in the after show, it'll be useless because it's not a big enough audience for the after show.
You know, maybe one thing to add to this is I know from all this, there's a lot of research that's been done into how people remember, how effective training is in general. And those numbers are horrible. People, when they go to a two-day class, they remember maybe 10% a day after the class, 5% a few days later, and then it's only 1 or 2% of what they learned. So I think that sort of shows how training just isn't a good vehicle to make it to allow people to learn something new. And I think that's something that Johannes also touched on. You have to have a community after the training where you can learn together and grow together. And I think that's been missing for a long time. And thankfully, there are a lot of initiatives happening there also from the larger certification organizations like Scrum Alliance and Scrum.org. So I think that's good. We're also doing that with our own company to really build those communities where people can then learn together. And then what they learned in the training also starts making more sense. So I think it's a bit of both. But training alone is not going to teach you much.
So I like that. It sounds like you're saying that the training can't be harmful because it's not effective enough. It's not effective enough to do any harm. But the training is, it's been equated to a driver's license. A driver's license is like an invitation to begin learning how to drive a car for real. And training is an invitation to a community. And that's the important part is once you've been through that training, and this is the way I explained it to Justyna. Justyna knew all this stuff, and she was offered a job as a Scrum Master. And I said, you know, you really ought to do the Scrum class, not because there's anything in there you don't know, but because it's a common experience. Everybody in the Scrum community has had that shared experience, mm-hmm. and it kind of opens the door to that community, and it makes you feel more like a part of it. And so if you really want to learn Scrum and do Scrum correctly, the important thing is not taking the class, but joining and participating in the community and learning together.
So I know you're an anthropologist, Paul, or at least you have a background in it, but so that makes this a ritual, right? A rite of passage.
Exactly. A new transformation.
You know, there's one thing, actually, Christian, when you were talking about this research and long-term outcome for the training, I remember, I think, 5 years ago at our conference that we do together with Paul and the ACE conference, there was Martin Florian who was on the stage, and he did a talk, hashtag no learning, about how no one will learn anything from this conference, how they are not going to use it, how it's not going to change their life, and how. And when you were saying about the training, I was just, you know, seeing that talk in my head. And to be honest, that was one of my the best conference talk that I've seen, even though as a conference organizer, I could feel offended, yeah? But he really touched some points that were so true and that really influenced the way how we put the conference together, how for us it's the experience of having, you know, 2 days of learning for people, how we just, you know, try to, you know, see it from the user experience, you know, perspective, instead of just, you know, the event when you just go sit, have a talk, have a coffee break, and, you know, all of the mechanism. Yeah, if the purpose is not there for the conference, the outcome would be as you describe of a training. Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But
it might not be the right thing to say in a podcast about reading books, but I do like the way that Marcin's mentor put it, which is don't talk to me about what you read, talk to me about what you did.
And Johannes, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, so I just wanted to share one of my favorite moments after I gave a training and then subsequently worked with the team, right? So when I work with the team, then I make sure they have the basic knowledge first, so we have a common ground. And when I use certain terms, then they know what I'm talking about. But there was a moment in our first sprint when the team members were discussing some kind of product backlog item, and someone said, but hold on a minute, what would be a good way for us to get quicker feedback on that? And at that moment or at that time, there was still confusing what review was and retrospective and things like that. I was totally fine with that, but there was some kind of essence that they understood that came from the training, right? And so if you look at what with successful training is, then to me it's not, you know, I completely understand the mechanics of Scrum, but that shift in mindset essentially of, you know, we used to work one way and now we work a different way. And kind of the essence of Scrum, if they've understood that, then I'm really happy about that.
I think that's a really nice way to wrap up the conversation about training.
Yeah.
I've got one more question I really want to ask before because we're running really long on time here, and we've been doing that lately. I think it's a pandemic thing. I have a lot more time in my hands, and so this podcast has been getting longer and longer and longer, but I'm aware that that's not true of everybody. But one of the things that I really like that you did in this book is you acknowledge that failure is an option. Not only did you acknowledge throughout the book that mistakes are essential, but you also acknowledge that failure to save a team from zombie Scrum is a thing that absolutely can and will happen to you over the course of your career. Could you tell us what are the signs that you're out of options? When you're a Scrum Master and you're trying to rescue a team from zombie Scrum, what are the signs that it's time for you to move on and do something else? This isn't working.
So essentially, when the system doesn't budge one inch or for a really long time, you've just smashed your head against the wall. And so I just want to talk for a quick second about something that I see a lot, which is that a lot of Scrum Masters work with teams in an organization and it doesn't go so well. And so they kind of project the perfect agile environment onto other companies, right? And so they give up quickly and they leave the organization and believe the next company, that's the one that's going to be really great. And they know how to work in that fashion and I get all the support that I want, and then they get disappointed there. So there's always like a certain amount of disappointment that you will have to tolerate. But if you've been trying for a long time, the problem itself is very apparent. So what we often talk about is, you know, you need to point out what the actual issue is to the organization or to the people involved. If you just tell people, hey, we're not doing Scrum the right way, no one is going to care, because people just don't pay any attention to that. But if, for example, the problem is really on the table, like we have a goal of quickly meeting our customers' demands, it takes 1.5 years for us to release one idea into the market. How does that fit together? It doesn't make any sense to me. And people kind of say like, yeah, but we're not going to change it. You know, that for me, that's one of the signs that it might be time to look for something else. I don't know, Christian, what do you think?
Well, I think that's already a really good example of when to stop. And I would add to that the personal note that if you start feeling burned out by by the work that you're doing. So if you become cynical, but that's what I mostly mean in this case. So if you become very cynical about the organization, about the team, I think that's a sign to start looking for more radical solutions, which could include leaving the company and finding another job or another position within the same company or an escalation to the highest level of management that you can think of. But it's not healthy to stay in an organization or in a team for a long time when you're cynical. That's going to infect other people too. It's not good for yourself, for the people around you. So that's also an indicator to look for, I think. That's a good sign that it's time to move on.
I think that's something that anybody who's been in the industry long enough has experienced.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it will happen, I think, to everyone at one point, and that's okay. I think that's okay. And I think we need to talk a bit more maybe about that rather than all the success stories that we usually share and in conferences and in meetups. But that it can be really incredibly hard to create change, and sometimes it doesn't work.
Now, among designers, there is... No, it's not designers. I know where I came across this. I was at an anthropology conference once. Every once in a while, I like to go to a conference outside of my immediate discipline. It's amazing what you can learn. But I went to an anthropology conference. I think it was called EPIC in London, Anthropological Praxis or Ethnographic Praxis in Industry. And one of the talks was about the emotional roller coaster that is doing ethnographic research. And this understanding that when you go into such a complex situation, you are going to have dramatic ups and downs. And I think change agents should be aware of that too. You're going to have good days and bad days. But if the cynicism becomes persistent and you can't shake it off, then you are no longer solving the problem. You've become part of it by becoming a victim of it.
Exactly, yeah.
I think that's a fantastic place to wrap up.
Well, it was a pleasure to chat with you, Justina and Paul. It was a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to the episode.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for joining us for this conversation. I hope you found it as interesting as we did. Justina, we went a long time once again.
But at least, Paul, this time you were not dominating conversation because there were other people too. So it went like evenly. So the reason why it's longer, it's not because we have a lot of runs, but it's because other great people could join us too. So I think that would be interesting experience for our listeners too.
I was also really enjoying myself. I found them both to be charming conversationalists. And even though I'm not currently working with any Scrum teams, I recognize all of the patterns that we were talking about. I recognize the feelings of being in those patterns. And I really appreciate that the Liberators are out there and helping people through these difficult times. So something I want to draw everyone's attention to is this survey that they're doing, which is a reasonably simple survey. I mean, it's not a simple survey. It's a pleasure to complete because it's very well structured and it's a very interesting way of introspecting on your experiences of working with your team. The survey that they had mentioned is live and they're gathering a lot of very useful data and they're gathering this data over time. And so if you're interested in reflecting yourself on how healthy your Scrum team is, then I would strongly recommend following the link that's going to be in the show notes and taking that survey, because you'll not only be helping yourself to think through some of the things that are going on with you and your team at work, you'll also be contributing to a body of knowledge which is going to be used in order to help diagnose the industry. But also, because they're going to be tracking the health of Scrum teams over time, by all means, just because you've gone and filled in the survey once, you can come back again after your next retrospective, a month later, a quarter later, a year later, and fill it in again so that they can get some sense of the way in which zombie Scrum is evolving and hopefully drifting into healthier and healthier states of Scrum nirvana. So help out, contribute, and it'll be useful for you as well, because it's an interesting exercise to think through these questions. What did you think, Justina? You filled out this survey.
Yes, I feel it out, and I felt like I'm doing retrospection with myself, you know? I really liked it, and there are two options. You can choose faster and shorter. You can choose how detailed you want to have your survey. You can choose like 10 minutes with a basic questions and a short diagnosis, or you can choose more comprehensive with 20 minutes. Of course, I chose 20 minutes. I will do 10 minutes during the weekend just because I'm curious. But to be honest, it gave me a lot of to think. And that's also helped me to catch up some notes on what I want to tackle during the next meetings with my teams. What are the problems that they might have? Because when you are operating, you know, in such a complex environment, sometimes you are missing some key points. So it really gave me a lot of to think of. And it took me more than 20 minutes, to be honest.
All right. I wish I could do it myself. I'm just not presently working with the Scrum team. So, but when I am, I will certainly contribute as well and experience it for myself. So thank you everyone for joining us for this conversation. I hope that you found it enlightening and useful. And I've got some more information. Not comprehensive information, but some more information about what to expect a month from now. We had kind of left you hanging there because we're reading this Knevin book, which is an edited collection of articles and journals and blog posts and such. Really, really nicely put together, I got to tell you.
I love it, Paul. I love the idea for the book. Mm-hmm.
Oh. Don't save it for the podcast.
I will. I'm trying.
Save it for the podcast. This podcast is about the Zombie Scrum Survival Guide. The next podcast is going to be a treat because it's a wonderful book. But anyway, I have been in touch with the editors and we've talked about some different ideas for interviews. And I think what's going to be really interesting is just an interview with the editors of this collection. And the reason why I think this is going to be interesting is twofold. Number one, they have gone above and beyond when it comes to editing. So an enormous amount of thought and effort, and not just editing, I would say curation is a more appropriate word, because they weren't just editing to make sure that the right material was put into this book. They put an enormous amount of effort into designing an experience and multiple different kinds of experiences. And we'll go into more detail about what I mean by that in the next podcast. But partially because of that, a great deal of effort went into the creation of this book. And so I think a conversation with the editors is going to be fabulous. But the other reason is that Dave Snowden talks a lot. I mean, not like I do, but I mean, he's a man of just amazing energy and enthusiasm, and he's incredibly eloquent. And so most of us have probably heard Dave Snowden talk about Knevin at some point, either at a workshop or in a YouTube video or at a conference or one of the recorded conference talks. And I not to be mean, but I could listen to Dave Snowden forever, but I think it's important to remember that Knevin is not Dave Snowden. It wouldn't exist without Dave Snowden. Dave Snowden is a critical member of the community, but Knevin is a community, and there's a whole community of thinkers and practitioners who are all contributing to the growth of this body of knowledge. And so I think it'll be really interesting to have a conversation about Knevin with Knevin practitioners and thinkers, for once, who aren't Dave Snowden. No offense to Dave Snowden. But let somebody else talk.
Yes. I couldn't agree more, Paul.
So, by all means, look up Dave Snowden's talks. They're absolutely brilliant. If you haven't heard his children's birthday party story, I don't know what you've been waiting for. But there will be a link to that in the show notes in the next episode, because I don't want to distract from this wonderful book, The Zombie Scrum Survival Guide. But if you want Dave Snowden, he's everywhere. But I think you're going to enjoy joining us a month from now when we talk to the editors of the next book as well. So that's a little less uncertainty for you after our last podcast. And of course, join us in 2 weeks when Eustin and I will be talking about this wonderful edited collection of articles and blog posts and journals and such.
Stories and such stories.
Yes, yes, okay.
I just bite my tongue. I'm told we have to finish because I will say something that I don't want to say.
If you keep going, I'll have to edit it out and then just stick it into the next episode. But I think we've done enough for today. So thank you so much for joining us. Join us again in 2 weeks. You're a lovely audience. We love you. Bye now.
Bye-bye.